The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
I'm Virginia Prescott with a special edition of Word of Mouth. Two writers reimagining slavery and wildly original fiction. Colson Whitehead and Ben Winters joined me in front of a live audience for the In the Spotlight series at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord, New Hampshire. Today we'll hear that conversation about making the leap from what we already know happened to what could have happened. In his National Book Award-nominated novel, The Underground Railroad, Whitehead turns the metaphor of the title into an actual subterranean network of trains.
I had the idea for the book 16 years ago. I was sitting on my couch and came across a reference to the Underground Railroad and thought of when I first heard about it in fourth grade or fifth grade and envisioned a literal network of tracks, a subway. And of course, my teacher explained that that's not how it worked. It's sort of impractical. But I thought, that'd be an interesting premise.
That premise kicks off the mythical journey of a teenage slave named Cora, who escapes a Georgia plantation and boards an underground train going northward. She stops in several states, not geographical, but more like stages which reflect the nation's historic treatment of African Americans. Around the same time that Whitehead was working on his book, Ben Winters was kicking around something similar.
Let's take this figurative idea, in a way, slavery is still with us, which we can talk about all the ways that that is unfortunately so, and make it literal. Slavery is still with us. And that's the lens. That's the idea.
In Winters' novel, Underground Airlines, the Civil War as we know it was never fought. Abraham Lincoln was assassinated before his inauguration, and slavery continues in the present. An industrialized, corporate-owned economic powerhouse operating in four southern states under protection of the Constitution. We started the evening with National Book Award nominee Colson Whitehead reading from The Underground Railroad, one of the most anticipated literary novels of the year. The scene is the Randall Cotton Plantation in Georgia, where an enslaved girl named Cora lives. Another slave, Jockey, is celebrating his birthday. You'll hear the name Caesar, who's urging Cora to run away with him, and Chester, a 10-year-old, who, like Cora, is an orphan, and she's taken him under her wing. They are all owned by the brothers James and Terrence Randall. And a warning here, the Underground Railroad is unsparing in depicting the inhumanity and brutality and sexual violence against slaves. This reading is no different, so parents and sensitive listeners are advised.
The music stopped, the circle broke. Sometimes a slave will be lost in a brief eddy of liberation, in the sway of a sudden reverie among the furrows or while untangling the mysteries of an early morning dream, in the middle of a song on a warm Sunday night. Then it comes always, the overseer's cry, the call to work, the shadow of the master, the reminder that she's only a human being for a tiny moment across the eternity of her servitude. The Randall brothers had emerged from the great house and were among them. The slaves stepped aside, making calculations of what distance represented the right proportion of fear and respect. Godfrey, James's houseboy, held up a lantern. According to old Jockey, James favored the mother, stout as a barrel and just as firm in countenance, and Terrence took after the father, tall and owl-faced, perpetually on the verge of swooping down on prey. In addition to the land, they inherited their father's tailor, who arrived once a month in his rickety carriage with his samples of linen and cotton. The brothers dressed alike when they were children and continued to do so into manhood. Their white trousers and shirts were as clean as the laundry girl's hands could make them, and then the orange glow of the lantern made the men look like ghosts emerging from the dark. "Master James," Jockey said. His good hand gripped the arm of his chair as if to rise. "Master Terrence." "Don't let us disturb you," Terrence said. "My brother and I were discussing business and heard the music. I told him, 'Now that is the most god-awful racket I've ever heard.'" The Randalls were drinking wine out of goblets of cut glass and looked as if they'd drained a few bottles. Cora searched for Caesar's face in the crowd. She didn't find him. He hadn't been present the last time the brothers appeared together on the northern half. You did well to remember the different lessons of those occasions. Something always happened when the Randalls ventured into the quarter, sooner or later. A new thing coming that you couldn't predict until it was upon you. James left the daily operations to his man Connolly and rarely visited. He might grant a tour to a visitor, a distinguished neighbor or curious planter from another neck of the woods, but it was rare. James rarely addressed his niggers, who'd been taught by the lash to keep working and ignore his presence. When Terence appeared on his brother's plantation, he usually appraised each slave and made a note of which men were the most able and which women the most appealing. Content to leer at his brother's women, he grazed heartily upon the women of his own half. "I like to taste my plums," Terence said, prowling the rows of cabins to see what struck his fancy. He violated the bonds of affection, sometimes visiting slaves on their wedding night to show the husband the proper way to discharge his marital duty. He tasted his plums and broke the skin and left his mark. It was accepted that James was of a different orientation. To hear his valet, Prideful, tell it, James confined his erotic energies to specialized rooms in a New Orleans establishment. The madam was broad-minded and modern, adept in the trajectories of human desire. Prideful's stories were hard to believe, despite assurances that he'd received his reports from the staff of the place, with whom he'd grown close over the years. After all, what kind of white man would willingly submit to the whip? Terence scratched his cane in the dirt. It had been his father's cane, topped with a silver wolf's head. Many remembered its bite on their flesh. Terence said, "Then I recollected James telling me about a nigger he had down here could recite the Declaration of Independence. I can't bring myself to believe him. I thought perhaps tonight he can show me, since everyone is out and about, from the sound of it." James said, "We'll settle it. Where is that boy, Michael?" No one said anything. Godfrey waved the lantern around pathetically. Moses was the boss unfortunate enough to stand closest to the Randall brothers. He cleared his throat. "Michael dead, Master James." Michael, the slave in question, had indeed possessed the ability to recite long passages. According to Connolly, who heard the story from the nigger trader, Michael's former master was fascinated by the abilities of South American parrots and reasoned that if a bird could be taught limericks, a slave might be taught to remember as well. Merely glancing at the size of the skulls told you that a nigger possessed a bigger brain than a bird. Michael had been the son of his master's coachman, had a brand of animal cleverness, the kind you see in pigs sometimes. The master and his unlikely pupil started with simple rhymes and short passages from popular British versifiers. They went slow over the words the nigger didn't understand, and, if truth be told, the master only half understood. But they made miracles, the tobacco farmer and the coachman's son. The Declaration of Independence was their masterpiece. Michael's ability never amounted to more than a parlor trick, delighting visitors before the discussion turned, as it always did, to the diminished faculties of niggers. His owner grew bored and sold the boy south. By the time Michael got to Randall, some torture or punishment had addled his senses. He was a mediocre worker. He complained of noises and black spells that blotted his memory. In exasperation, Connolly beat out what little brains he had left. It was a scourging that Michael was not intended to survive, and it achieved its purpose. "I should have been told," James said, his displeasure plain. Michael's recitation had been a novel diversion the two times he trotted the nigger out for guests. Terence liked to tease his brother. "James," he said, "you need to keep better account of your property." "Don't meddle." "I knew you let your slaves have revels," Terence continued, "but I had no idea they were so extravagant. Are you trying to make me look bad?" "Don't pretend you care what a nigger thinks about you, Terence." James's glass was empty. he turned to go. Oh, one more song, James. These sounds have grown on me. George and Wesley, the musicians, were forlorn. Noble and his tambourine were nowhere to be seen. James pressed his lips into a slit. He gestured, and the men started playing. Terence tapped his cane. His face sank as he took in the crowd. You're not gonna dance? I have to insist. You and you and you. They didn't wait for their master's signal. The slaves of the northern half of the plantation converged on the alley, haltingly, trying to insinuate themselves into their previous rhythm and put on a show. Putting on a show for master was a familiar skill, the small angles and advantages of the mask, and they shook off their fear as they settled into the performance. Oh, how they capered and hollered, shouted and hopped. Certainly this was the most lively song they'd ever heard, the musicians the most accomplished players the colored race had to offer. Cora dragged herself into the circle, checking the Randall's brothers' reactions on every turn like everyone else. Jockey tumbled his hands in his lap to keep time. Cora found Caesar's face. He stood in the shadow of the kitchen, his expression flat. Then he withdrew. You! It was Terence. He held his hand before him as if it were covered in some eternal stain that only he could see. Then Cora caught sight of it, the single drop of red wine staining the cuff of his lovely white shirt. Chester, the boy, had bumped him. Chester simpered and bowed before the white man. Sorry, master, sorry, master. The cane crashed across his shoulder and head again and again. The boy screamed and shrank to the dirt as the blows continued. Terence's arm rose and fell. James looked tired. One drop. A feeling settled over Cora. She had not been under its spell in years, since she brought the hatchet down on Blake's doghouse and sent the splinters into the air. She'd seen men hung from trees and left for buzzards and crows, women carved open to the bones with the cat o' nine tails, feet cut off to prevent escape, and hands cut off to stop theft. She'd seen boys and girls younger than this beaten and had done nothing. This night, the feeling settled on her heart again. It grabbed hold of her, and before the slave part of her caught up with the human part of her, she was bent over the boy's body as a shield. She held the cane in her hand, like a swamp man handling a snake, and saw the ornament at its tip. The silver wolf bared its silver teeth. Then the cane was out of her hand. It came down on her head. It crashed down again, and this time the silver teeth ripped across her eyes, and her blood splattered the dirt.
Colson Whitehead, reading from his National Book Award-nominated novel, The Underground Railroad. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, with a special edition of Word of Mouth, Colson Whitehead and Ben Winters recorded live in the Spotlight, a co-production of Gibson's Bookstore, the Capital Center for the Arts, and NHPR. Colson Whitehead's newest novel is The Underground Railroad, set in a parallel, mythical version of pre-Civil War America. Ben Winters' book, Underground Airlines, is set in the dystopian present, where slavery is legal in four states. Before the break, we heard Colson Whitehead read a scene from The Underground Railroad depicting the barbaric treatment of slaves by a plantation owner. It was that brutal beating that sets Cora's escape and the novel's plot in motion. I sat down with Ben Winters and Colson Whitehead in front of a live audience to talk about their books and to take questions submitted by the audience. I began by asking them about their research, what they read and what they learned about the realities of American slavery before taking the imaginative leap into fiction. Here's Colson Whitehead.
I did have this idea for each state being a different state of America, and so every 60 pages, as Cora goes to South Carolina, North Carolina, the novel is rebooting. But I wanted the first section to be the historically accurate part. I wanted to be truthful to the reality of the experience, honor my nameless great-great-great-great-grandparents who died somewhere. Was it Georgia or Florida? I have no idea. They're sort of in the black hole of slavery. So just to honor them and the other slave dead. So I reread some of the big slave narratives I studied in college, like Frederick Douglass, Harriet Jacobs. Harriet Jacobs was a woman who fled her master and hid in an attic for 7 years before getting passage out of North Carolina. And she became partially an inspiration for having a female protagonist. But in the 1930s, the government paid writers, the Works Progress Administration, to interview former slaves, people who'd been teenagers or kids at the time of the Civil War. And there are hundreds and hundreds of accounts. Some are two paragraphs, just about farming. Some are about master-slave relationships and run 10 pages. And I would go through just sort of hoovering up nouns and adjectives and verbs. You can say, you know, master beat somebody, but scourging was a common verb as a synonym for beating. And so finding the right language and the sort of quotidian details that make a historical portrait live, I mostly got from the oral accounts from the 30s.
What is it like writing those scenes? I mean, they're harrowing. Do you charge in because they're accurate and you want them to be real? What did that feel for you writing them?
Well, I mean, the more research I did, the more I realized I'd have to put Cora and the supporting cast through, and that was depressing. I hadn't been that brutal to my characters before, and then I just think about people who actually went through it, and that's another level of horror, contemplating people who actually went through the things I was reading about. So I had a real sense of dread, and then the opening of the book is a 6-page sort of biographical sketch of Cora's grandmother, from her abduction to dying on the Randall plantation. And I wrote that, you know, really quickly, and the voice of the book came in writing that section. And I found the right distance. I think if you want to animate your characters, you have to be in there and in the experience in order to make it vivid, but also step back in order to shape the material as an artist and think about the reader and are you telling the story at the right pacing and putting the right details in. Once I started writing and got Cora's grandmother's story down, I found that sort of nice place where I could be in it and then apart. And then, of course, I would knock off work at 3 p.m. and come up from my office in the basement and rejoin my family. So I kept the work very separate from my life.
I'm thinking of the criticism after the 12 Years a Slave film. Do you remember when Steve McQueen, who's the director, who's British, one critic called it torture porn. And there were a number of people who were Academy voters who said, I just can't go there. I can't even look at it. Is there any fear of, you know, inciting that?
Well, in terms of the reader, you know, the reader's response, this is the way it was. And so it's not one of those happy slave narratives. You know, it's not about Scarlett O'Hara being self-actualized by the Civil War. So I didn't worry about it being too brutal. That's just simply the way it was. And sometimes I would step back and think, oh, is it just too violent? And then I would just go back to the research and think, no, it's not.
Well, there is actually, in one of the states that she travels to, South Carolina, there's a section of a museum called the Museum of Living History. And it's this alternate view of history, you know, painting this kind of like primitive life in Africa and the happy middle passage, you know, this kind of thing. And she's participating in this. That's her task, while people press their noses up against the glass. And it made me wonder about the version of history that we do get.
No, yeah, I mean, there are a few things. You know, once I depart from being from historical record, I'm allowed to play with time. And so former slaves were put on display in carnivals, world's fairs, dressed up in so-called jungle garb and supposed to represent African natives. They were in sort of living dioramas. So by departing from what actually happened, I can sort of move stuff from later in the 19th century and have Cora interact with it. I certainly, when I was in fifth grade, probably had one unit on slavery, and it was like, slaves exist, and then Lincoln came. And in terms of Jim Crow, separate but equal, and the various forms of oppression before the Civil Rights Act, I think I had like 1 hour in sixth grade, and then Martin Luther King comes, and I think that's how we receive history, is like in this really short chunks where we don't dwell on the bad parts, because they're understandably really difficult to teach, to contemplate, whether you're black or white.
You're listening to Colson Whitehead and Ben Winters, recorded live in the Spotlight Cafe for a special edition of Word of Mouth. Well, for you, Ben, in your speculative fiction, you redo all of those events, right? You know, beginning right. with the Lincoln assassination and the Norman Rockwell painting of little Ruby Bridges walking to school, to totally different contexts. The blaxploitation films are different contexts. James Brown has a different alternate history. So how did you build that world? Do you begin, you know, sort of with Lincoln assassination or some kind of crossroads of history and build backwards? Or
sort of. I mean, the high concept, once I had established that I knew I wanted this to, the idea of the book was going to be that there was still slavery now, I labored to make it as realistic as I could in every detail, which is a sort of paradoxical task because it's not what happened. So you're trying to convince the reader that if this had happened, then it would look like this. So I did start with that, with Lincoln being assassinated on his way to be inaugurated. And what I discovered was there was a speech that he gave from a hotel balcony in Indianapolis. He was making his way from Springfield to Washington, and he gave this speech that was considered to be inflammatory toward the South. And the next morning he had to go back, as politicians sometimes do, and walk it back. And so I seized on that moment, and I had him shot on that hotel balcony. And then the nation, there's a wellspring of grief and collective mourning and sort of outrage, and the Congress comes together to pass a compromise, as they had with the Missouri Compromise and the Compromise of 1850. But then those small details that you mentioned, all of it came from just, that's the sort of the crossroads of the research and just your imagination as a writer. Like, I decided that there are some historical figures like James Brown, like Michael Jackson, who actually plays a kind of a role in the hero's imagination, like Martin Luther King Jr., who, even though this is an alternate sort of dimension of American history, the force of those people, they would still have their role to play in history. And I think it's a little bit of a kind of an interesting dimensionality for the reader to discover those names and those stories that they know, to come across them and see how this great change has made these smaller changes along the way.
Right, and in the scene that you read about, he was driving a Pakistani truck.
Right.
So why are they driving a Pakistani truck?
Well, because a lot of the civilized world won't trade with the United States of America. So our great trading partners in the book are South Africa, Pakistan, China. And then I talk about in the book how it's just a little detail, but he listens to a cassette player in his car because CD technology is Japanese, and the Japanese have been, until recently, a signatory to the European consensus, which is essentially that the U.S. sucks. I have a brief speech in here that I quote Henry Kissinger on the occasion of us withdrawing from the United Nations, which I feel like Kissinger would have, so he would have loved to do that. So there are things like that where, the laughter I appreciate because it reflects that there's a kind of a resonance, an interestingness. But then I also wanted to make sure that the details and those little fun, quirky bits weren't pulling away from the narrative. Because I never wanted this book to be, look how clever and interesting. The point of the book, the sort of moral resonance, the moral force of it comes from, we're talking about the connection between a historical evil and a contemporary problem. And so never did I want this to be the kind of book where people just read and go, oh, cool, man, that guy really imagined the hell out of this. You know, that would be the wrong reading, I guess.
A couple of questions in that vein. You were talking about contemporary America. Can you comment on the role of fiction in our nation's ongoing and often brutal political discourse?
That question was for Colson, right?
It says CW and BW on it.
Okay. I have no idea. I mean, I don't know what role fiction has. I don't know how novels can change things. I mean, I hope that in doing the research and writing the book and animating the story, I had a better perspective on how the world works and how I feel about things. And I think if, in playing with history in different ways in the book, the reader can pick it up and have a different perspective on how America works, on how slavery works, and what has changed, what hasn't changed, I think that's sort of nice enough. But I guess I sort of have a pessimistic view of how art changes people.
Ben?
I mean, I guess I have a, I don't, I wish that I felt that the novel was so central to American cultural life that a book like Coulson's or mine could sort of have a moving force on people's perceptions or the people's interactions with each other. I do think that in recent years there has been a spreading consciousness of what is, you know, systemic racism, institutional racism, a sense that racism is not just a problem of an individual against an individual, but rather something that is in certain ways baked into where we are as a people. I think there has been a spreading understanding of that, hopefully, and I think that literature can be part of that, or hopefully is part of that. You know, I'm not entirely pessimistic.
No, yeah, you'd hope. I just, you know.
I will say one thing.
It'd be
like,
nice.
Yeah. when the book The Confessions of Nat Turner came out by William Styron, which was in the 60s, I think, there were huge protests at some of his readings because he was a white author, and some of the ways his portrayals of Turner were considered to be, in certain ways, quite racist. And so there was a backlash and some huge protest. And I'm white, and although I hopefully have avoided those kinds of racist portrayals, I had anxieties about the fact that this book features a black narrator, and so it crossed my mind, oh my God, what if there are protesters when I do a reading of this? And of course there wasn't, and I think in part because books aren't as big a deal as they once were in general. Am I right about that? I
mean, they're protesting on Twitter, though.
Yeah. And that's right. So
but did anyone, you know, I know one publisher actually passed on this because maybe they thought it was too sensitive. But did anybody say to you, your agent, you know, anybody say, don't do this?
Nobody said, don't do it. People said, and they were right, to do it respectfully and do your homework. And I, hopefully I did. It wasn't a question of, I knew that, this was the book I wanted to write. I felt that writers, and I think white people and white writers, have a responsibility to be reckoning with this history. And so that's why I got involved in the material. The question of whether to have a black protagonist, I couldn't have done this book with a white protagonist. It just wasn't the way to tell this story. So I just did it.
I'm Virginia Prescott with a special edition of Word of Mouth. Today, a pair of writers, Ben Winters, author of Underground Airlines, and Colson Whitehead, author of The Underground Railroad, recorded live in the Spotlight, a co-production of Gibson's Bookstore, the Capital Center for the Arts, and NHPR. Their novels imagine what life as a slave could have been in a parallel, mythical version of pre-Civil War America, or in a dystopic present where slavery is still legal in four American states. Both Whitehead and Winters cited two influential works of speculative fiction that they turned to when preparing to write their most recent works. In Philip Roth's novel, The Plot Against America, Charles Lindbergh wins the 1940 election against Franklin Delano Roosevelt and signs a peace treaty with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. Philip K. Dick's The Man in High Castle is set 15 years after the Allies lose the war and Japan and Germany divide up and rule over the United States. Both of those speculative novels use World War II as a defining moment in American history. I asked Colson Whitehead and Ben Winters if we reached another. Do you think we're at one of those crossroads with, you know, two radically different visions of the country being laid out in front of us, and also this kind of the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement and the fear that it invokes in some people? Are we at one of those points?
Well, I think, you know, the election is very important. Go out and vote.
We're in New Hampshire. Please go out and vote.
But, you know, I think we advance very, very slowly. You know, I think looking over my life and my family's history, obviously my grandparents would be very excited to know how their kids progressed up the economic ladder and became middle class. But I think I think progress is so incredibly slow, and a lot of the stuff that I talk about in the novel under different names persists and continues to define black life. I think periodically we have these discussions about police brutality now, with Rodney King in the late 90s in New York with the torture of Abner Louima, when I was growing up in the 80s with the treatment of people like Michael Griffith, a graffiti writer who was choked to death by police, Eleanor Bumpers, a mentally disturbed woman who was killed by EMTs who should have been trained and had to deal with her. And then, you know, we briefly talk about police brutality, and then our American amnesia sets in, and we forget about it until the next eruption, and then the same sort of cycle continues. With Black Lives Matter, I think the conversation has continued for longer than usual, and who knows what kind of changes it will bring. But I think it, you know, progress is, you know, sometimes excruciatingly slow when it comes to matters of race in America.
I would just add to that that just today, in the last couple of days, we have a person running for president who is encouraging his supporters to go to polling places in certain areas and monitor and make sure that nothing is going on, which is just one of many ways that if you look at the contemporary scene, you can see linkages going back and back and back to, you know, polling place violence and disenfranchisement is just something else that reaches from the past that we're seeing. So,
Colson, in your book, Cora goes through these various different states, as you said. It's kind of this episodic tale, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Indiana. In South Carolina, for example, they're basically government-owned, these suddenly freed people. You know, they work at the company store, get paid by the government, and there are eugenics experiments being conducted on them. In North Carolina, it's a white supremacist state. I'm just trying to think about, like, how did you assign those to particular states? Was there any accident in that or calculation?
It was mostly random. I mean, she could have started in Florida and gone to Georgia. So in terms of the names of the states, it was sort of random. I knew I wanted to have these different sort of islands, like Gulliver's Travels. And so South Carolina would have its own scheme in North Carolina. And again, just making that decision to have a literal railroad, I was freed from the burden of the historical record. I wasn't going to get kicked out of, like, the historical novelist union for changing things. And so how can I use that, these deformations of reality, to broaden the conversation? So she goes to North Carolina. She's trapped in an attic like Anne Frank. And the language of the white supremacist state in North Carolina echoes the language in Nazi Germany. So how can I talk about the demonization of the other in 1850 in America to talk about the persecution of Jews in 1930s and 40s Germany? And so it's not just about slavery, but about demonization of the other in different time periods, different kinds of people. And how can I make those linkages and erase the difference between oppression? And so I think it goes back to what Ben was saying before about building a world. Logically, how do you build a white supremacist state? And you just sort of proceed of how it would be credible to you as a writer in person. How would things have changed if the government bought all slaves and gave former slaves jobs and housing, and how could that play out?
So carrying on with plausibility, could you imagine a turn of events that could bring back slavery for real?
No. I mean, I know what that question is getting at, and I do think that there just in the last year, and certainly in the last couple of weeks even, we've reached a level of rhetorical heat and a level of out-and-out racism and, I think, fascistic rhetoric in political speech that we don't see in this country, and coupled with a sort of reckless disregard for American institutions and the way that we've sort of built up over centuries now of political tradition, democracy, the democracy of the value. So is that related? Do I think that could lead to bring back slavery? No, but I think it could conceivably lead to very bad things and an undermining of a lot that we hold dear.
Yeah, it's not something I worry about day to day.
Thank you.
But slavery does exist in different parts of the world. So, and then I can be stopped in the same way that a freeman was stopped in 1840s Georgia by a slave patroller to see if I have my papers. So that form of stop and frisk that existed 160 years ago, where you had to have your ID to travel, or else you'd be jailed, beaten. If you ran away, you'd be shot. So I live in an echo of that situation. Slavery doesn't have to exist for you to feel enslaved in different moments in your life.
I want to piggyback on what, there are 38 million people, I think, by some reckoning, who are literally enslaved around the world, including in various countries like India that have very active slave populations, and sex trafficking in the United States. So, lest we forget, that's all.
So, Colson, you mentioned patrollers, and a lot of questions here are about Ridgway. He is the slave catcher, has a very well-developed worldview based on order, and white people, of course, are at the top of it. People want to know how hard it was to get into Ridgway's mind. Someone wants to know if Ridgway was a real person or if there was some real person who inspired that.
Sure. No, I mean, it's always hard to get into a character's head. I think making up your characters and your protagonists should be difficult, you know, otherwise, you know, why do it? It took me a while to get Ridgway's voice, and so for a long time I had insert Ridgway biography here. You know, hopefully he's a good villain who can stand up to Cora. You know, I think she's very strong, and so I wanted to have that kind of Ahab-obsessed figure who's hunting slaves and hunting Cora. He's not charming, but I was conceiving him as falling into that charming sociopath villain I think we like in literature and film.
He feels almost supernatural, the character, and I think it's in his persistence and his sort of like his dead eye on her. It feels very supernatural.
No. Well, and plus he has, you know, the guy who travels with him with a necklace of ears around his neck.
It gets a bit Baroque, you know, that section, I must say, but yeah.
Well, Ben, of course, your main character is a bounty hunter slash slave catcher and operating in that same sort of way that, you know, there is a law that Fugitive Persons Act, you have to turn them in. You know, even in the North, somebody who's a guest at a hotel has to register as a guest of color. You have to know that somebody is a free black person.
Well, right, which I think does reflect the historical reality that, and this actually comes up in the Underground Railroad a lot, is the idea of the free black people always, regardless of their free status, having to look over their shoulder and be concerned about the possibility of a slave catcher snatching them illegally. It happened a lot. And actually, after the, it was either the Missouri Compromise or the Compromise of 1850, a lot of African-Americans then, free blacks, even those who had been born free, took the opportunity to leave the country because the Fugitive Slave Law was given new teeth. And it was suddenly this fear of like, oh, well, all of a sudden, we're just going to get snatched right and left. And that definitely, it's a very, it's a minor sub-theme, but it does come up in my book, the idea of free black people fearing that they're going to get illegally snatched and stolen. And I think it's a reflection of the idea that even in our contemporary American society, and this is exactly what Black Lives Matter is talking about, just the value of black life is less. Of there being more fear, more anxiety, more chance of being arrested, and then if you're arrested, more chance of going to jail, more chance of going to jail for longer, all those things.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is a special edition of Word of Mouth. Today, a conversation with Colson Whitehead, author of the National Book Award-nominated novel, The Underground Railroad, and Ben Winters, whose latest novel is Underground Airlines. Both of these books made me think a lot about the sort of psychological wound and what people carry of slavery. Like in Cora's case, we heard in what you read, before the slave part caught up with the human part, that she jumps on Chester to save him. And along the way, she meets people who are, you know, newly escaped slaves who are just looking around. You know, they're haunted by what happened to them before. They're expecting the absolute worst. And thinking about what the psychological damage of that is over from generation to generation to generation.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was writing the book last year, and so how could I make a plantation that was psychologically realistic to me? And so all of us here listening have an idea of what PTSD is and how it trauma lingers over the years and decades and forms your personality and deforms your personality. You know, a slave is not post anything. They're experiencing the torture, rape, brutality of plantation life every day. And of course, they're completely messed up in the head. Cora is abused, and when she leaves, it determines the size of what she can see for herself, of who she is, what kind of freedom she can conceive of. Can she love? What kind of love will it be? So it was important to me to find a psychologically credible character and plantation. I mean, I think we have an idea from pop culture of the plantation where everyone is sort of helping. There's like Uncle Tom maybe, but everyone is sort of helping each other. But it seems to me, maybe this is my dim view of humanity, if you have 100 people in a room, you know, 10 are great and 10 are terrible, and most of us vacillate between those extremes. If you have 100 people on a plantation and you've been brutalized every day of your life, from the time you wake up to the time you go to sleep, you're not going to help each other. You're going to be fighting for a scrap of dirt, extra food, for an extra blanket. And so the plantation is very brutal because it seemed that that's how people would be so deformed by the experience.
One of the things I read when I was researching this and trying to figure out what a contemporary plantation would look like is my hero, we have some sort of flashbacks to his life growing up, and he works on a slaughterhouse. and I read a memoir of a gulag in North Korea. Because right now in North Korea, there are millions of people who live in essentially concentration camps. And just as you were describing that idea of 100 people in a room, it's quite like that. The idea that you all these people, and they're all suffering under the same boot heel, but they turn on each other. And there are sparks of humanity and sparks of nobility, but it's a very depressing and demoralizing and traumatic experience.
Well, that's the thing, that everybody is affected in both of these novels. And it's not also just those who are enslaved, but it is all the white people who are complicit in their own way. Ben, in your novel, there are the clean hand state and those who are not. You know, there's a kind of righteousness that people can hold themselves in, a regard.
Right.
Can you explain the clean hands?
Yes, there's a federal law called the Clean Hands Law that requires northern states are not allowed to sell or make use of goods that were made in the four slave-holding states. So most of the trade of the slave states goes overseas to our international trading partners. And the northern states, many people in the north pride themselves on not using any slave-made goods or buying any slave-picked produce and so on. And as it was in antebellum America, in places like New Hampshire or New York or Connecticut, I think there was often a sense of, oh, well, God, yes, of course, slavery is terrible, but, you know, it's not my fault. What am I doing? You know, it's not my responsibility. I actually read a book called Complicity that was written by reporters from, I think, the Stanford newspaper, and it was all about the way that, for example, shipbuilding empires in Rhode Island and banking industries in New York, all over New England and the Mid-Atlantic states were built on money that flowed north from slavery at the same time that many Northerners were sort of congratulating themselves and feeling good about that we are the good part of America. So when we think about things like slavery or contemporary racism, it's a question of complicity, of what not only are what are we actively doing, but what are we actively allowing to happen by our day-to-day choices.
And also in your book, Colson, white people who are helping slaves are also killed. They're also the victims of this. It's just that nobody is left untainted.
Well, I mean, they're all trapped in the system. Obviously, right. A slave master has an economic stake in perpetuating slavery. If you don't have slaves and you're in Louisiana in 1850 and slaves actually outnumber white people, how can you contemplate freeing slaves when they'll be understandably a little peeved at how they're being treated? And so, and then there are obviously white abolitionists and people who help an underground railroad. And then I think a lot of people, and you know, I was trying to have, because I reboot the book every 60 pages, I can have a big cast. And so there are whites who help, whites who don't help, and whites who don't care. I mean, I think in the same way that I'm not up all night thinking about Syria or slavery in the Philippines, not every white person in 1850 is thinking about slavery. They're trying to just put food on the table, and they live in New Hampshire and Massachusetts, and they're going out their daily business without having any strong opinion either way. And so, and that's in the same way that there were slaves who didn't help a fellow slave who needed help. What the structure of the book helped me to do is have all these different people and minor characters who have different attitudes and different engagement with the peculiar institution.
Well, I want to pick up on that point that Ben said, you know, both of you alluding to this kind of idea of complicity, that, you know, we're all living our lives, but are we all implicated by, you know, the cell phone videos that are taken of people being mistreated, killed, beaten up, otherwise targeted by police, you know, that evidence? Are we all implicated in it in the same way that this other institution, the institution of slavery, carried on while people looked the other way?
I don't know.
Yes? I mean, we're a society, right? We're a civilization. We're all Americans. We're all in this together. And I think that part of what is so revolutionary about this, I guess, age of YouTube and the rapid transmission of these videos, that things are being seen by people that have, I can only presume, been going on in various forms throughout the history of the Republic. And I think that it does ask of people that exact question. Well, every time one of these videos comes out, and Colson said this before, which I think is absolutely true, there's this sort of, there's a burst of national conversation. You know, there's a week or 2 weeks of hand-wringing, and then we tend to go on to whatever the next thing is. Or we go, okay, well, here's the solution. It's body cams. We got to get body cams. All the cops are going to wear body cams. We'll have dash cams. And then we did it. That's it for racism. Take care of that. And because I think that people look to what's the answer. Here's the problem. The problem is people getting shot or beat up. So what's the answer? Oh, here it is. It's body cams. As opposed to going, well, there's a massive problem here that's been going on a long time that isn't gonna sit still for a quick solution. So I do think it allows everybody to recognize more than they might otherwise that we're all involved in this.
I guess I'd say, aren't we complicit in every sort of moral outrage? Isn't there more we can do about every sort of thing that's terrible and undermining our sense of worth in the world? I think you pick up the line about the human part of her superseding your slave, the slave part of her. And I think we all have that slave part of her ourselves that sometimes gets in the way of our human part.
Colton, you before in the past you've talked about, you do a deep dive when you start writing your books, elevator operators or gamblers, professional gamblers. And now this book has been one of the most anticipated of the year. It was an Oprah book pick. The president brought it on his vacation with him. So are you being looked to as a person now who people want you to be a commentator on race, some kind of healer? Are they looking to you for that?
Well, I think people want an answer. I think I'll get asked, what do you want to say with the book? And I'm like, well, the book, if I could just say it in a sentence, I wouldn't have written the book about it. And then you can have different interpretation of the ending, but some people say, it seems so bleak that, there's all this torture. Is there a place of hope? And it's not my job to provide hope. I've hopefully put together an artistically coherent text that people can interpret different ways. But I don't really have any prescriptions except what Bill and Ted said, be decent to each other or whatever, I think that's my usual rule, as much as I can live up to it.
Okay, so I know you guys both started your books some time ago, but right now there are a number of different books and a lot of interest in the Underground Railroad in particular and also in slavery. I'm thinking of Yar Jesse's book, Homegoing. Underground, it's a series on television, has been renewed for a second season. Django Unchained, 12 Years a Slave, Eric Foner's book that you mentioned about the Underground Railroad. So what... Because you have taken these giant imaginative leaps and describing these differently, did that allow you to say something new about slavery and the legacy of racism in this country, do you think?
Well, I think for me, by not sticking to the facts, I was allowed to talk about changing concepts of race from 1850 to 1910 to 1960 and now, and have a larger idea about slavery's after effects throughout the decades. So I think I was lucky that I had a structure that could allow me to sort of rove and play with history in different ways.
Yeah, I don't think I said anything new, but hopefully the frame of the book allowed readers to see it in a way they hadn't seen it before.
Please do join me in warmly thanking Ben Winters and Colson Whitehead. Colson Whitehead, author of The Underground Railroad, and Ben Winters, author of Underground Airlines, recorded live for the In the Spotlight series, a partnership between Gibson's Bookstore, the Capital Center for the Arts, and NHPR. Our thanks to Michael Herman, Elizabeth Jewell, and the staff of Gibson's Bookstore. NHPR broadcast producers are Taylor Quimby and Jimmy Gutierrez. Digital producer is Sarah Plort. Event producer, Angie Lane. Our special thanks to Vivian Lewine, Lynn Sabian, Lauren Gregory, and Ben Blanchard at the Capital Center for the Arts. Music for this broadcast from Blue Dot Sessions. Colson Whitehead and Ben Winters also joined us for our 10-Minute Writer's Workshop podcast. You can hear a wide range of authors sharing their ideas and encouragement when you subscribe to the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop podcast on iTunes and Google Play. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thank you for listening to In the Spotlight, a special broadcast of Word of Mouth from NHPR.